Hi, everyone. Thanks, Bradley. I appreciate being asked to chair today's panel discussion. RAA has long argued that infrastructure investment is critical to avoid worsening congestion and increased vehicle emissions and road safety risks and, of course, the deterioration of the state's highways and freight routes. And, of course, it's hardly surprising then that we would adopt this position given that we're the state's peak motoring body. But RAA also recognises that the state does face fiscal challenges and believes resources ought to be directed in a manner that will raise the living standards and deliver economic benefit, plus providing the greatest return on investment. So it is with these priorities in mind that before the election, we wrote to the government and released our pre-budget submission calling for 8 critical transport infrastructure priorities. And when Charles Mountain from RAA down there had a big smile on his face because 7 of them were funded for in the state budget, we all knew that it was good news from an infrastructure perspective. But most importantly, we felt that those infrastructure priorities that we called for would help future-proof living standards for South Australians, which is really important. So we know what the state needs now. It's time to start thinking about the long-term infrastructure needs of South Australia and discuss the role of transport in unlocking future economic development. So I'd like to now introduce Michael Waite. Michael is the Chief Operating Officer and Senior Systems Engineer at Shoal. Shoal has been involved in some very interesting complex projects, and I was interested to learn that Shoal's been working very closely on the Air Warfare Destroyer and Future Submarine programs, both programs close to my heart from my former days at ASC, and also critical projects to the state. The organisation adopts a systems-led approach to complex projects, and it'll be interesting hearing Michael's views on how we tackle some of our complex infrastructure projects using that systems thinking. Michael.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Minister, and thank you, CEDA, for hosting this event today. The Minister today outlined his vision for transport and infrastructure, the future for South Australia, and where we can take these projects and these outcomes that we seek to achieve. And these are all driven by our changing environment, changing needs. We have changes in our demography. We have an ageing population, people moving back into the city centre, increasing the population density. We have changing technology, things happening, greater levels of performance, greater interconnectedness of information. We have changing societal expectations, where people want things faster, better, cheaper, more reliable, safer. And we have changing direction with the change in government, change in priorities, change in policy. And all of these changes represent an opportunity to realise great benefits for the state. So benefits in the transport and infrastructure domain allow us to access jobs, access healthcare and education, drive our economy through the exchange of goods and services and ideas, and allow us to connect to each other as people and engage in social activities and recreation. And so with these benefits also come great challenges. And the Minister spoke about understanding and appreciating risk. And these risks come as a result of, you know, increased complexity in our projects, shortened timeframes and reduced budgets. And we as a community delivering these outcomes in the transportation and infrastructure domain need to be looking for innovative and effective ways of delivering these outcomes. And so we look for new approaches or enhanced ways of doing things, such as looking at the disciplines such as systems thinking, which allows a greater appreciation and understanding of how things come together, are interrelated, and how they can together achieve greater emergent properties and outcomes. And so it's through using approaches such as these, we can work together as a community in the transport and infrastructure domain to realise these outcomes that the Minister talked to today. And we're seeing the benefit of such approaches. Transportation agencies around the world, Singapore Land Transit Authority, New York City Transit, London Underground, and indeed here in Australia, a number of transportation agencies and organisations are using systems thinking approaches to help understand right from the very beginning of their projects, understand the problem that they're trying to achieve, understand the outcomes that they are trying to realise, and ensuring that those benefits and outcomes are understood right the way through that conceptualisation, design, testing, implementation, and ongoing through life support. So we look to these approaches to achieve better outcomes for our projects, that we can realise a greater value proposition for our organisations, where we can do things better, cheaper, deliver things faster to our clients, and also be able to deliver these outcomes and value to our community in the form of those transport and infrastructure projects which allow us to connect to each other as people. So I encourage everyone here today to really look at how we're using our time to best serve the realisation of those outcomes, and think about how the Minister was speaking about using a technology agnostic approach, but rather look at understanding the problem that we are seeking to achieve and ensuring that we keep a focus on that vision over a longer term viewpoint, so that we can truly understand and realise a benefit for our community here in South Australia. And that was all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I'm now pleased to invite Professor Rocco Zitto, who's the professor and head of civil engineering at Flinders Uni, to come up and speak. So Rocco's latest work in the driverless vehicle space is particularly fascinating. And when I spoke to Mark Borlase, who is our head of future mobility at RAA, a little earlier today, and he told me Rocco knows it all, I thought, well, that's a pretty big expectation right there for what Rocco's got to say today. But he's been fueling South Australia in the driverless vehicle and autonomous vehicle space, as well as exploring other new technology advances that we can make in this area. And it's been particularly good, Rocco, being in South Australia, because South Australia has in fact been leading the country on championing autonomous vehicle technology, which, Minister, we hope we can continue to do. So as new technology in transport offers cheaper and eco-friendly solutions, Rocco's research becomes even more critical for a modern transport future. Rocco.
Thank you, Jane. I just wanted to start off by being very clear to everyone. This will be an exam and worth 20% of the assessment. Sorry, wrong audience. Let me really start by thanking CEDA for the opportunity to speak. Where I did really want to start is that really there's nothing more certain than change. We've heard that from the Minister, we've heard that from Michael now. And actually, this is not such a good thing for infrastructure or transport because they usually have very long lifetimes. If we look at the way we do transport now and the way we're performing our transport task, it's going to be, I'm very certain, that's going to be very different in the future. So how do we plan for that, and how do we plan for that in terms of the infrastructure we need? Transport is absolutely going through disruption. So what are some of the drivers of this disruption? And Michael's hinted on some increasing population. This is Adelaide, this is South Australia, not the fastest growth rate in the world or the country, but some ABS stats say we're going to hit the 2 million mark by about 2061, so about 43 years. Or, Minister, about 10 election cycles. There you go. Another daunting task for infrastructure, a significant increase in our ageing population. Again, ABS says we're going to double the number of people over 80 by 2061. So in terms of our socio-demographics, there's large changes are coming. Attitudes are changing. Millennials, I have a couple, have very different priorities to baby boomers and Gen X. Ask a millennial what they'd rather lose, their driver's license or their mobile phone. Okay. In contrast, I'm a baby boomer, and Gen X, driving is independence, okay? A rite of passage. You're not going to take my license away from me until I die. So very different mindset. New technologies, absolutely always evolving and coming. We've heard a little bit about electric vehicles. Once they get cheaper and have more range, which they are already doing, they're going to become much more prevalent. The manufacturers know this. Already some commitments from some major manufacturers to go to full EV production in the next handfuls of years. Connected and autonomous vehicles, been doing a lot of work in that space at the moment. Really, the safety benefits we're going to get from these types of vehicles are really going to be what the next generation of safety on our roads is going to be about. I think within vehicle, all the airbags, ABS, all that sort of stuff, we're probably kind of at the limit. The next generation of safety systems will be what we can do outside the vehicle in terms of connectivity and the like. And with that, with these new technologies, we really are seeing a transformation now from private transport ownership really to mobility as a service, just like our mobile phone. We want to make a call. I want to go somewhere. Who's going to do it for me when I want for the cheapest price? So there's an interesting space there. And I think mobility as a service really has a good opportunity, along with autonomous vehicles, to provide enhanced mobility options for people who don't have them at the moment, the very old and the very young. Community expectations are changing as well. They want mobility for everyone, all the time. Absolutely don't want any environmental impacts. They want economic prosperity as well. And we don't want to wait for any of that. It has to happen now. So what does this mean for SA infrastructure now? Well, one of my previous hats in Engineers Australia, we looked at SA's infrastructure in 2010, and it was adequate. 2015, it improved slightly. Well, what does that mean? You'd never be one of my postdocs, that's for sure. So actually, I agree. So in my independent look, you know, we can get around electricity, okay, to, you know, price is a bit high, but we have a big battery, that's great. We can drink the water, absolutely. Might not taste very good, but we can absolutely drink it. We manage our wastewater. Telecommunications, we've been helped a lot there, especially by the federal government and the rollout of the NBN and the like. So Engineers Australia also believes infrastructure development is a crucial enabler of productivity and economic growth. Absolutely it is. Absolutely. I totally agree with that as well. So there's a lot of responsibility for the infrastructure and the infrastructure we're planning for the future. Planning. So we need a plan. So all those in the audience that have been in this game as long as I have and stuff start to roll their eyes. And we've had plans. We've had lots of plans. I'm old enough to remember MATS, we have an integrated transport and land use plan. We had a 30-year plan for Greater Adelaide. We had a strategic infrastructure plan for South Australia, which are all been great. Actually, it's quite courageous for a government to put up a plan because it can always come back to haunt them. But through the infrastructure and through those plans, you know, transport and land use integration, I think we've ticked that box. We know a lot about congestion management now and transport and land use. Public transport, investing has been a focus, minimising those environmental impacts, ensuring equity. You know, a lot of no-brainers there, really. North-South corridor. And investing in public transport, I mean, very, very obvious for most cities around the world, really. So what needs to be different this time, okay? Because now we have a new and wider, much wider set of community expectations. Transport and really the other utilities as well are really undergoing disruption. So now, all of a sudden, a transport minister has to think about all the electrical infrastructure that's going around as well. Electric vehicles and recharging. Want to see an electricity provider sweat bullets? Tell them you're going to have 10,000 electric vehicles in the middle of the city fast charging. See what kind of infrastructure that they need for that. Transport. It's around 14% of the energy use. So as we transition to these electric vehicles, our energy requirements are actually going to increase in terms of electricity infrastructure. Transport and communications, you know, connected and autonomous vehicles, they are going to need to realise these safety benefits. They are going to need to talk to other vehicles and the road itself to realise those safety benefits. The other thing that's different that we need to do, we probably haven't done so well at, is really take advantage of the economic opportunities that stem from building all this major pieces of infrastructure. We really need a whole of government approach beyond transport, the transport ministry. We need industry to work together and academia, all working together in this approach. And is Infrastructure Australia the right mechanism or tool for that? I don't know. We might find out. Role of government. Let me volunteer government to do a whole bunch of stuff. Really, government really needs to get the best advice it can on infrastructure. And, you know, it's really a small cost, much, much less than 1% of a construction cost. You know, the minister, you know, was saying in the last budget, billions of dollars being spent on infrastructure. How have we modelled that? How are we looking into the future? Have we looked at other jurisdictions? What are we doing in the post-evaluation as well? And that's been mentioned before. Government will probably fund and own a lot of that infrastructure, which is always interesting. We've just had a budget, and I'm sure the minister had a lot of interesting conversations with the health minister and the education minister, the opposition, and maybe even the federal government to try and earmark that funding for that future infrastructure spend. Government needs to make sure that all the infrastructure, the systems thinking approach beyond transport, but beyond the silos that we used to live in, is actually coordinated. It makes sense. All South Australians need fair and equitable access to all this infrastructure, public infrastructure that we're building. Again, how does a government position itself and the state so that we take that full economic advantage of all of this? And after we build it, government will probably have some sort of responsibility in managing it as well. But there's industry. We have a lot of industry players in the room today, and they'll probably end up funding and owning some of this infrastructure as well. And they'll probably build and design most of it. They'll manage some of it for government and absolutely take advantage of the economic opportunities that come from it. Academia, well, we're all about what's next. I'm already looking over the horizon, blue sky thinking, all those good keywords and stuff. Trials. If we trial the new technologies at a university and we can use modelling techniques or whatever we can to try and get that mass uptake, I think that staged approach is a very sound one that's worked a lot of times before with new technology products. The independentness, is that a word? Of universities. When we do a national and an international review of best practice in infrastructure, you know it's going to be unbiased. Where research is at heart, we just want the best solution available given the constraints that we have to deal with. That's my engineering speech for everyone. We're also here to educate the next generation of professionals who are going to plan, build, design and maintain all of this infrastructure. So that's a very important role academia is going to have into the future, and always has really, as well as upskilling the existing workforce we have. And that's where I'll end today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to invite the Minister now to join us on stage. We're going to have an open discussion and invite some questions from the floor. I'll kick off, but when if you do have a question, just pop your hand up and there are a couple of people with microphones that'll keep an eye out. And then when it's your turn, just announce your name and where you're from. And I prefer my voice over everyone else's, so if you could just limit it to a question and keep the statements to outside, that'll be great. But just to get started, though, North-South Corridor, it's probably, I'd say it is, the largest infrastructure investment in a single corridor that our state has ever had. Now, we don't want to stuff it up, so we've got some key parts left to go, right? The trickiest parts of the North-South Corridor, and I'm putting it simply. And previously, we've adopted a bit of a brief design, construct and deliver type model for these projects. Michael, do we need systems thinking?
Yes, I absolutely agree that we do need systems thinking. I think there's an opportunity in every project to apply a level of systems thinking approaches. Whether or not the project is a fairly straightforward, simple thing that someone can do such things in their own mental models and do it within their own head, or whether such a significant complex project such as the North-South Corridor, such as the new RAH, or anything of that size and complexity, it requires more sophisticated approaches and techniques to be able to ensure we articulate what's going on, have a shared understanding between all of the stakeholders, and ensure that we understand and identify, you know, the risks and issues as early as possible, and are able to treat those and manage those, and have a clearly articulated understanding that both sides of the line can understand from both the government and also the supplier. So absolutely, definitely think there's an opportunity for systems thinking in such a project.
Rocco, you're nodding, so...
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And that was my point from before. We're approaching a time now where it's more than just building a road. It's not civil engineers digging up some pavement and putting it down a bit wider than it was. It's the integration between all the communications technologies, all the vehicle technologies, or the road sensors that are happening. And we need to integrate that sensibly so that we can get the outcomes that we want.
Minister, we're going to see the completion of North-South in the next 3 to 4 years, which is fantastic. But what's next? What's the next big one?
Well, I think that's a pretty big statement, 3 to 4 years. that'd be pretty good. Can I say
that
I...
be, Minister.
And I'm just trying to do the maths in my head, but I actually think we're going to spend more on these remaining 11 kilometres of the corridor than we did on the other 67 of them.
Mm-hmm.
You leave the hardest bits till last. And there is an existing design on the table, sort of underpasses at the city end and overpasses at the other end. I think tunnel technology has changed and it's time for us to have another look at it. But this is a very difficult decision for us to make because it has, we're talking about systems thinking, it has a whole heap of moving parts. And it's why we're out there to market at the moment to develop the business case for the remaining sections of the North-South Corridor, but why we're also putting out our Globelink business case at the same time, because the two things, the idea is that they can potentially work together, but it's why we need it to actually fit in and integrate with the integrated land use plan. And I noticed you talk about it before, Rocco, and I've got a very firm view that infrastructure to the greatest degree possible needs to be bipartisan, and it's not something that is naturally going to happen, and we've taken things in a different direction what the former government did, but what we have been keen to do is to complete the visions of the former government, whether that's their whole heap of infrastructure projects that are going on at the moment, the Gawler Line electrification, the City Tram Extension project. We haven't wanted to sort of stop and start again because we know there's a whole heap of sovereign risk, but also a whole heap of wasted cost. And it's why, for instance, we haven't chucked out the integrated land use plan. It's something, a document that's going to evolve, but I think that... there needs to be a level of pay it forward when it comes to these things. And I think I've said a number of times that I'll open projects that I didn't start and start projects that somebody else will get to finish. But hey, if we can do North-South in 3 to 4 years, then maybe we'll be around long enough to do it.
We might take a question from the audience.
Good afternoon, thank you. I'm Phil Harrison, City of Playford Minister. Noel, congratulations on securing the Gawler Electrification Rail Project. Have you considered extending that project through to the Barossa Valley, namely Nuriyupa, and into your electorate, and creating a bit of tourism and
Somebody put you up to this?
Growth in that area.
Yes, and the answer is no. And this is a perennial, and my electorate's the Barossa Valley, this is something. Passenger services stopped in the Barossa in 1968, and it's about 35 odd kilometres of track, and the rough estimate that someone's given me is about $400 to $500 million. We've just spent, or are spending, what is about $500 million on Northern Expressway. There's about $800 or $900 million on the Northern Connector. That's a really good bit of kit. In fact, it's my favourite road in the state. And again, I think there's a whole heap of benefit that we should be getting out of the existing infrastructure that we've spent. Having said that, there is an argument if you were to, say, turn the Barossa from a 15 to 20,000 person settlement into a 100,000 person settlement, that the maths changes. But without that, the business case, even in its rawest form, doesn't stack up. But that's not to say that we're anti-rail or anything like that. It's we need to treat each project on its merits and understand how it fits into the integrated land use plan. And the former planning minister, John Rao, set a hard thing called the urban growth boundary, and it now takes two houses of parliament to change it. I think that the last parliament made a very strong decision about what Adelaide looks like, and that is going to drive where our infrastructure investment goes and public transport infrastructure investment goes into the future.
Question from the audience over here.
Yes, thank you. David Cruikshanks Boyd's my name, from WSP, the global engineering firm. Question for the Minister. Sorry, Minister, you're probably going to get lots of the questions today. Firstly, though, I'd like to say that my favourite bacon is Barossa double smoked bacon. I have it every Saturday and Sunday. So as well as being with WSP, I was also the National President of Engineers Australia in 2015. I was really, really delighted to hear you broach the subject of risk allocation in major infrastructure projects. It's certainly something which bedevils the consulting sector and no doubt also the construction sector. I just wonder whether you're able to elaborate a bit more on that, and in particular how you're going with the battle with Treasury on that.
Well, I'd love to be able to elaborate, but I actually have to be extremely cautious in what I say and talk in the abstract. But Treasury, actually, I don't think are our natural enemies here. Treasury, sure, say no to everything, but somehow we magically still get to spend money. And them saying no to everything means that we have to focus and probably have to work harder to get a yes, and that's not a bad thing at all. And the other point is that Treasury really loves it when we get money out of the federal government. So they're the things that we say yes to, because it really does help the budget bottom line. But in relation to risk, it's just a... And again, I mean, I've chatted to the procurement experts in my department and looking at this abstractly for quite a while, and it's a perennial issue. And I don't think we've got it right. I think it's an evolving feast, and, you know, we have these new PPPs, design and construct. We're going through this new PTP alliance to essentially provide different ways to spread risk. And at least this last, this alliance model, which are currently building Oaklands Crossing and doing some planning study work on park and rides and the Northeast Transport Study, seems to me to be a good way, because it's a shared risk in the sense that we share in the upside and we share in the downside. That to me seems quite an honest pricing of risk. And in the end, talking to the Deputy guys, that when they procured that, essentially the argument was around the different partners on their margin, because everything else is fixed. And I think we have to be honest about the fact that we need companies to have a margin, otherwise they end up like York Civil, and that doesn't do good for anybody. And so I think government has come to accept that getting a cheaper price out of a contractor is a zero-sum game, because you win, they lose, and we have to take an economy system-wide perspective rather than a... just looking at it from a government perspective. But more than that, you make it more difficult for someone on this project, it may come back to bite you on the next project, or all sorts of struggles around you know, getting financing and a whole host of other issues that if we try to push off the risk, it comes home.
Rocco, we're about to see the biggest infrastructure spend since that 2009 budget, Minister, around there.
Oh, well, no, I think it's record ever.
But that's in
today's dollars.
So. Sure. And last week's budget has been applauded by many industry groups, excited about the pipeline of infrastructure projects. But Rocco, are we investing in the right infrastructure?
I think at the moment with the budgets that has been released, I mentioned before, we've got a lot of no-brainers in there. North-South Corridor, investing in public transport, absolutely, and stuff. So we are bringing this city, this state, towards a better transport infrastructure. But university person, looking over the horizon, what's next? How can we provide the enhanced mobility services that our community is really providing for? So not only it's going to be the combination of different types of infrastructure all working together to provide those enhanced services. Autonomous vehicles is one, electric vehicles, mobility, all these things that will come together. But, yeah, our spend now, absolutely. It's something we have to do.
Mm. We might take another question from the audience just here.
Yeah, hi, Shane Phillips here from Telstra. To
I'm not
three
late.
Of you, firstly, it's industry, academia and government that are on the panel there, and I think that's a fantastic piece, and I want to hear from each one of you about how you see the triumphant of the government, academia and industry working together on the future vision of transport. I understand the budget's good for current, but how do we look to work together better in the future? That's really my question. To the three of you. Start away. Anybody?
Why don't we start with you, Michael?
All right. Look, I think in any sector, whether it be transport, infrastructure, defence or healthcare, there is an opportunity for the collaboration between industry, academia and government. I think there's a wealth of opportunity that comes from the research and innovation that comes from our universities. There's a lot of really great skills and experience that live within the public sector and government, and the decision making that is made there, and also the drive and the know-how within industry. And I think the only way we need to make sure that we provide the environment for those areas to come together and actually embrace the opportunities that exist there. And I think at times we, and I know even from the industry perspective, we can play quite guarded against our potential collaborators in academia or government, but we need to make sure that we look at these opportunities with a positive intent, that we can seek to get a mutual benefit out of these projects. So it comes with a lot from the attitude that we take. If we look at our peers as a competitor, then we're going to end up competing with those other domains. But on the other hand, if we look as an opportunity to collaborate, then I think we can really leverage some real benefits that come from each of those domains and perspectives that bring to bear those real outcomes.
Rocco?
Yep. Thanks, Jay. Yeah, let me give you a case study. I just happened to be running an autonomous vehicle trial out at Tonsley. Invite you all to log on to Flex's homepage and book a ride. But that was a really good example of the government putting forward some initial seed funding in their Future Mobility Lab Fund. Rocco getting to... I won't say what I was just... So the government putting together some seed funding in a couple rounds of Future Mobility Lab Fund. A university able to tap its favourite industry partners on the shoulder. Didn't have to tap them too hard, actually. The second easiest project in my career to get up and going. So it was really easy for me to test this new technology, testing this new technology. We're not there yet. So something that, you know, a technology that could be our future, needs some evaluation, needs some seed funding from government, some input from industry. I think that's worked really, really well. And it really, we're already starting to learn a lot of lessons from the trial. We've been going since the 19th of June when the minister hopped on board, unveiled Flex. We've still got the sheet if you want it back. And 1,200 people on board, you know, one of my KPIs is how comfortable are the public to ride on a vehicle that hasn't got a steering wheel or any pedals. Just got one of my engineering students with an Xbox controller. And they've been very happy. They have been happy. So happy that when I ask them, are you willing to pay for this service, they didn't say no. They mostly said yes. So with my transport planners hat on, that's really interesting. So if we want this technology, if we see this technology and this service that we're able to provide being taken up all over the metropolitan area or the state and regional areas as well, and there might be some announcements on that quite soon, Minister, mightn't there? Let's put him on the spot. That partnership has been a real exemplar. That project has been a real exemplar for that partnership.
Minister, before you get your chance to answer your question, just a quick plug for the RAA SA Motor magazine, which runs a lot of stories on Flex. And you can, if you're a member, delivered to your door, you can read up all about it and also participate in the survey if you ride Flex, and we'd love to get your thoughts on that.
And priority bookings, Jane.
Priority bookings too. For RAA members.
Yep, absolutely.
Minister, you were...
And I actually think, and to take it from a utilities perspective, I actually think something we need to do a whole lot better. If I build a roundabout, the building the roundabout on road bit costs about $1 million. But if I don't look what's underneath the road, it can cost $5 million. And I think from a planning perspective, ITLIP, for instance, is pretty good at marrying where we think the residential growth and commercial growth is going to come from vis-a-vis what the transport network looks like from a road and PT perspective. But, and I noticed Monash Bindi's in the room here somewhere from the UDIA, has been kicking on to me about this for quite a while, that the missing link in ITLIP is around utilities planning, and we are going to have to tackle that, especially as we see a real shift from greenfields development to urban infill. Where are the utility capacity constraints? Where are the sweet spots where we can potentially get more out of the existing infrastructure that we've spent? And that's going to require some very frank and honest conversations between all the different players, and that is some work we're keen to get cracking on. But it is extremely important, because if we get it wrong, there is going to be some huge issues, not the least of which, take the City of Adelaide, for instance, a whole heap of apartments going up, absolutely fantastic. But unless we make sure we've got the very basic and boring sewage capacity under the ground, it's going to create some issues. And those are the kinds of things we need to have regard to as we're putting these system-wide plans together. Because it's very easy to just, you know, look at surface and make the decisions about, where people are going to live and where they're going to drive to. But there's a whole another world under the ground that we need to look at, and probably has been the missing part of the puzzle.
Minister, RAA has been keeping a bit of an eye on some trials in China where trackless trams are running on painted road markings using sensors as a guide. Mm-hmm. And these trams are already being billed as being much cheaper to run, more eco-friendly, and could be a real game changer in terms of reducing infrastructure costs. Do we have, or are we positioned in our legislation and infrastructure planning to take advantage of progress like this in the industry?
Yes. In fact, I've seen the YouTube clips of those trams, and I really like the idea of a tram where you don't need a track or any container overhead lines. Apart from halving the cost, I think that there's a whole lot of technical difficulty that gets taken out of it. But in this space, and I'm actually keen to go and have a look at them at some point, but in this space, I don't think it pays to be the first mover. I think that, again, we should be permissive. And from a legislative sense, there aren't any real impediments. I mean, we have a legislative framework that the former government put in place that we agreed with around essentially giving Rocco the ability to break the law. And I sign off, which is very scary, to allow him to break the law.
It was day two, come on.
And that works for now in a trial perspective, but we're going to have a national conversation around what... Because it is illegal to run an autonomous vehicle, and in fact the entire transport legislation doesn't envisage somebody not being behind the car, and there are a whole host of issues around liability and responsibility that need to be dealt with. And we're going to have to go back, I think, to a principles-based bit of legislation. I know the department's very keen to do that body of work, but we can't do it in isolation. It has to be done at a national level, and that's where life gets difficult. I'm a great fan of a federalist system of government, but getting all the states and territories to agree on a consistent set of principles is not easy.
We might turn to public transport now. Minister, our RAA research would have our public transport patronage at around 10%. Now, do we fix the public transport system to build users, or do we get more people using it to justify investing in it?
It's both. It is a real chicken and egg question, and something we've been grappling with there with our new South Australian Public Transport Authority. And I think, again, the former government took a view that... take it back a step. I think that people's behaviour is driven by economics and personal choice. So unless the roads get a whole heap more congested, it's still relatively easy to use a car. Now, we can either, if we want to drive that behavioural change, and I think Michael would say, why do we want to drive that behavioural change? But if we did, there are a number of ways to go about it. You can either make the current system a bit harder, for instance, introduce a car park tax, or put a tram down North Terrace that'll make traffic down that road a little bit more difficult. but in all seriousness, I mean, it's not to say that we don't do the project, but these are the things that drive behavioural change. And we need to understand... And again, I think asking the right principle is to move the most amount of people as efficiently and effectively as possible. That's the right question to answer. What that looks like, I'm pretty agnostic. But in the end, I think from a government perspective, at the moment there is this. We spend whatever it is, $400 to $500 million a year on operating cost for public transport. There is a bucket of money that delivers us this system. We get 20% cost recovery, 10% of people use it. If we can use that bucket of money, reorient it to deliver a better system, we can encourage patronage. And I think once we can do more with what we've got, and then show that there is that we can actually make positive change, explain from a system-wide perspective why it is that that's positive, for instance, for infrastructure development on road or on other modes, then we can then put a business case together that incentivises further investment. So, for instance, let's take the Outer Harbour Line. It's one of the lowest utilised parts of the network. We have buses that run parallel to the thing. If, for instance, Rocco gets his autonomous trials up and running properly, if I could provide a first-mile, last-mile solution that takes people from the train station to their house and incentivise using people the Outer Harbour Line, if I can increase that patronage on that line, the business case for electrifying that line stacks up. So it's so many moving parts to put together, but in the end, to a certain degree, it has to be demand pull more than sort of supply push, in my view, because, again, it's about behavioural change.
Michael, can you apply your systems thinking lens to that?
Yes, I can.
Would you like to elaborate on that?
I absolutely agree. There's definitely a tension between both of those perspectives of, if you build it, will they come? It's about driving that behavioural change and understanding what kind of behavioural change you're trying to achieve for some particular purpose. People aren't catching public transport to get to the station at the other end. They might. I mean, apologies to any train spotters in the crowd, but people are using public transport to get somewhere and do something, whether it's get to their job or healthcare or school or whatever it happens to be. They're trying to achieve some objective in catching that public transport. So taking it even further, we can try and understand why people are undertaking these journeys, and perhaps we don't need to change our public transport system, but maybe move some of these services to where people are. Maybe changing start and end times of business hours to stagger them so that we don't have congestion with cars on the road at those times. Maybe those are the effects that we can achieve through no changes to our public transport system. We need to look at those type of approaches, but we can only investigate those solutions and opportunities by taking an appreciative view and using that evidence-based decision-making to really understand what's going on in the system, what levers we have, and what opportunities we have to change to achieve the outcomes that we're looking for. So whilst it might be that we're looking to increase the throughput of passengers, it would be to achieve some other purpose, to get them to where they need to be in time, safely, and reliably. So they're the kind of questions that we need to be asking to really capitalise on the very significant expenditure that we're laying out in this vision for the infrastructure and transport space.
Rocco?
Totally agree, Michael. Making these sorts of decisions on using the best data that we have is absolutely important. Best data that we have. 1999 was the last time Adelaide did a household travel survey. We actually surveyed 2% of the population and asked them to complete their travel diaries. 1999. Look, we absolutely have topped that up using new technology and stuff, but a blanket survey that covers the changing needs of transport in this city from so many years ago, I think is something that we really need.
Well, I was going to bring this up at some point today, but Rocco, we're going to have to chat because in little old South Australia, we had a app developer who did some transport survey work on a piece of road using some Bluetooth sensors. He then created this data, and it answered the question that it was asked to answer in relation to a specific project. But then what we had was a system that was developed that could tell us how quickly people in real time moved from A to B. That software developer then had a chat to a guy within the traffic management centre down at Norwood. And they thought, hang on, if we can do this and do this in real time, we can actually develop an app that's going to tell people where the traffic congestion is. And I think the rebrand is called AdInsight at the moment. We're moving to call it something else, which is on the top of my head I've lost. But essentially, we're already tracking where each one of you drives your car every day. I think there's a few hundred sensors around Adelaide and even up to the Barossa. And in fact, any time we redo an intersection, we put these sensors in there, and it's a partnership between Sage and the AdInsight team, which essentially is a commercially owned entity inside the Department for Transport. And we've actually licensed this system to almost every capital city in the country and are actually shipping it around the world, and I think we'll start to hear more and more about it. They're just about to launch the second generation where they can actually take part packets from people's mobile phone and Bluetooth connectivity in the car. So instead of, I think it's, I'm going to get the figures wrong, but it's about 6% of vehicles we can track. We're going to take that to about 40 or 50% of vehicles that we can track. And in real time, we're going to be able to understand traffic congestion. It saved me on Port Wakefield Road a number of times, but it keeps evolving and getting better. This answers the question. We can actually give real-time data on what's happening now, and then we can use that to model what potentially could happen in the future.
So there's still some more time if you have any questions. Now that you've finished your tiramisu, I expect they'll be flooding in. Just stick your hand up and one of our microphone bearers will come around. But in the meantime, you just mentioned, Minister, the tracking of vehicles. Interestingly, with the electric vehicle take-up rate, still pretty low, but we can see potential for future growth. Is there a possibility to look at introducing a road user charge option now while we can track what vehicles are doing?
Yeah, and to answer that question, firstly, can I say that the Liberal Party's election platform said that there are going to be no toll roads in South Australia And we stick to that promise. But having said that, we need to have a conversation because the way that we collect tax to build roads is dying. In the year 2000, we actually collected between fuel excise and road and registration charges about twice as much money as what we spent on roads. And it's this year or next year we actually hit the tipping point where we actually spend more on roads than what we collect in fuel excise. And that's because vehicles are getting more efficient from a petrol usage perspective. But also electric vehicles are going to change the game because they don't use fuel. And we've actually moved to a user charges system in relation to our port infrastructure, in relation to road, public transport. We have price signals within those systems all over the place. But it's never happened for vehicles on roads for a whole host of reasons. And from a heavy vehicle space, there have been heavy vehicle user charges for a while. We've got three trials going on in South Australia. But it seems to me like we've been trying to do this for a decade and a half and have not moved very far. And I think that this technology is actually going to force us to change extremely quickly. So every electronic vehicle, as I understand it, electric vehicle has GPS tracking in it. And we need to be able to tax it in some way to provide a level of equity to fuel-based vehicles, but also we need tax to pay for roads somehow. And this could be an opportunity, if we can, on a national scale, design the system properly to actually get to a more honest allocation of road infrastructure funding. I think the technology is going to force us to tackle what we haven't been able to do for 20 years.
Thank you, everyone. And, of course, if we can get that road user charging in with EVs, we might deliver north-south within 3 to 4 years. So something we think about. Thank you, everybody. We might leave it there. Please give a round of applause to our three panellists.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks, Stephen. Michael, that was great.